This time on The Real It Brief, we look back on INC 5.2, and we hear from Joe Papineski from Eunomia, who was in Geneva for the Global Plastic Treaty negotiations. We'll hear about the reasons behind why the talks came to an end without a treaty, what actually moved forward, and how the chair's draft text was received.
It went in many ways very similarly to INC 5.1. There's been a quite clear polarization actually going all the way back to INC 2 in Paris, where we do have this kind of big split between particularly the big oil producing nations and very big plastic producing nations. And there are certain topics like production reduction or restrictions or targets even, which go over a strict red line for some of those countries. And because the multilateral agreement process is based on the principle that you try to reach consensus and don't move away from consensus-based decision-making until you really have to, we've been in a kind of deadlock situation, really going all the way back to Paris. But that became clear in Busan in November 24. And then we repeated the same discussions in Geneva.
So if any, what were the positives?
So I think where we saw the biggest progress was in negotiation that did bring us closer to compromises that would still make for a worthwhile agreement, but that would bring a much larger number of countries in to play. So that was productive. Some of those negotiations resulted in creative solutions that hadn't been put forward before Busan. So we do now have a lot of text elements that could go into an agreement that would be reasonably ambitious, but reasonably likely to find wider consensus.
Before we move on, can you tell us a little bit about what the blockers to the treaty might have been?
There's been a lot of coverage in the media of the idea of petrostates holding the rest of the world to ransom. I think it's worth adding some nuance to that. Yes, it's true that we have this like-minded group of countries that is led by the very major oil producing nations and that is very aligned with some of the big plastics producers. I think the nuance I would add to that is that we also have a substantial issue around how the agreement's going to be funded and that there is a major split between the high income countries, the developed countries and developing countries, where we don't have consensus between what the financial mechanism for the agreement should be or where the money is going to come from. And actually, in that split, you have Saudi Arabia and Russia and Iran on the same side as the high ambition developing countries. So I think it's worth people just understanding that, as with climate finance, there's a substantial financing issue here. And certainly from the work we've done, we think that the role of private sector finance is a potential solution or partial solution to that challenge.
Now, we've spoken at length about the primary plastic polymer fee on this podcast. How was that received in Geneva?
There's pretty broad consensus that the private sector needs to play a substantial role, that the polluter pays principle should apply, and that we have two broad categories of private sector actors who might contribute. One of those under EPR, what we normally define as producers in extended producer responsibility, which is the brand or the company putting product on the market. But the other is the polymer producer. There are lots of advantages to going upstream to the polymer producer for some of the funding towards implementing an agreement like this. There is interest in that. There's obviously quite a bit of resistance from the producing companies and some of the producing countries, but there is support from some producing countries. And it's also potentially an elegant mechanism to address the funding gap that's really there, because the traditional donor nations, so the US, the EU countries, the UK, Canada, Australia, are not feeling as generous as they have done traditionally. And so it's very unlikely we're going to get really substantial official development assistance money flowing from those traditional donors.
Can you explain what the final few days were like after the first revised chair's text was received that landed on Thursday?
It was hard to read what the chair's strategy was, to be honest, on the ground. And that's not just as an observer, but speaking to lots of delegates, including from some of the most powerful countries in the world. We were all a bit confused as to exactly what the strategy was. So we had a draft chair's text land on Thursday morning, and that really was incredibly watered down versus the chair's text that came out of the officially adopted chair's text that came out of the Busan meeting at the end of November. It had the feeling of a text that was designed to make more ambitious countries feel more positive about a less compromised text, but still a very compromised one. So it felt like it was really there to lower expectations. Having said that, it lowered them so much that actually, for once, we did have consensus in plenary that followed it, with it being rejected by really all sides for different reasons, but it was ultimately rejected by the High Ambition Coalition of Countries, the like-minded group of oil and plastic producing countries, and everyone in between. So it looked like he took it too far with that draft. The draft that subsequently came out just under 24 hours later, which was the kind of still quite compromised, but maybe people would feel more positive about it, having had their expectations lowered, was still very substantially compromised. I spoke to some international environmental law experts who said that actually the first text that came out on the Thursday actually lowered the bar from existing international environmental law. So it actually went backwards versus what we already have in other agreements and convention. And the second draft probably got us just above that, but not much. And so it really lacked any global obligations. It was very much a framework, but actually without a really clear means to strengthen it either, because the decision-making process for the COP, we still had three options in play at that point. So with the timing that it came out in the middle of the night between Thursday and Friday, it was too late to resolve the square brackets and the options that were still in it anyway. So it narrowed things down a bit in some areas that were helpful, but it was never going to be able to be the basis for reaching agreement. Even if they'd had a marathon plenary session on Friday, there were just too many options to work through and talk about. It would have just timed out. And we still had the fundamental problem that we didn't have a consensus of countries. As I understood it, actually some of the like-minded group of countries would have done. So there were a number who had kind of split off from the direction that the Saudi Arabia delegation was taking. So we were beginning to see a split there, which was interesting because we'd already seen some debate as to whether there was going to be a fracturing of the High Ambition Coalition, but we definitely saw the beginning of a fracturing of the like-minded group as well.
So how do we move forward then? What's next?
In the final plenary, there was quite a lot of, there were, I think, the higher ambition countries who are also concerned about the health or otherwise of multilateralism were talking about another round and an INC 5.3. I think in the cold light of day and on reflection, and there were countries saying, actually, we really need a period of reflection here to decide what to do next. The idea, having done 5.1 and 5.2 and had ultimately very similar outcomes and very similar dynamics of the negotiations, the idea that you would just go again without a substantially different strategy and potential for a substantially different decision-making process probably doesn't make sense. So I think most likely we'll either have an INC 5.3, but with much more preparation done in advance for shifting decision-making towards voting or towards a smaller group of countries moving forward with maybe a compromise that Saudi Arabia wouldn't accept, but that some of the like-minded countries would. or an agreement being reached outside the UN process. And I think things to look out for over the next few months: the UN General Assembly takes place in the last week of September, and that will be a place where the failure to reach agreement in Geneva will be discussed, and options will be discussed, and maybe some attempts will be made to move the process forward through the General Assembly. And then in December, we have a UN Environment Assembly. So this is effectively UNEP's, the UN Environment Programme's equivalent of the General Assembly. And that's the body that provided the mandate for the INC. And so that body could potentially amend the mandate or make decisions about where to take the process next. I think it's pretty likely that by then we'll have a reasonable amount of clarity as to what the process is going to look like. But given the inability to get consensus across this really polarized debate, I think it's most likely that we won't have an agreement with 190 plus countries in it anyway.
Joe Papineski from Eunomia talking to us on the ReLoop Brief. And remember, you can listen back to previous episodes at reloopplatform.org, or you can subscribe or follow for details on when the next episode is released.